is our first interview of Edinburgh Fringe 2018 as we head on a 30-minute delayed, recently renationalised train up towards the Edinburgh Fringe. And I'm joined by...
Chris Drummond.
Chris, where are you from?
I'm from Adelaide.
And what's the name of your company?
Brink Productions.
Brink Productions, on the brink of Edinburgh this
That's
year
right,
as well.
Yes.
And what's the title of the show this year?
The Aspirations of Days Morrow.
Intriguing title.
Yep.
So let's have the story up to why that show's here at Edinburgh.
Sure. It's based on a short story by Patrick White, who's Australia's great Nobel laureate. It's a 1962 short story. The original title was Down at the Dump. And the line, The Aspirations of Days Morrow, is taken from the short story. And what we've done is basically taken the short story Holus Bolus. All of the text is there, pretty much. There's a few sort of lines that have been cut, but four actors share the telling of that story, which is set on the day of the funeral of a woman named Daisy Morrow, who is a scandalous woman of the town, and her very uptight sister is grieving for her, but was always ashamed of her actions. And you follow this small community to this funeral, and next door to the funeral is a dump. Next door to the cemetery is a dump, and there's another family called the Wallys who are in the bits and pieces trade. And the niece of Daisy Morrow slips away from the funeral. She can't bear the hypocrisy and slips under the barbed wire, goes into the dump, and she meets her next-door neighbour, a boy named Lum Wally, and they go on an adventure through the dump. And I guess what Meg does, this niece of Daisy, is she sort of finds the world that her aunt lived in, a world of adventure and danger and an escape from a small town.
Just a reminder to our listeners, as we're on a train, we may have our tickets checked. Various other things may happen, but we will plough on. Some short stories always seem to come to the eyes of theatre makers, and then they go, this needs to also be staged. What do you think are the qualities of this story that made you want to say, yeah, this needs to be staged, not just read?
That's a great question. I mean, I think the story, as I've just described it, is quite simple, really. But, I mean, it also contains sort of all the themes of death and love and the escape into a bigger life. There are great characters. There's 12 sort of major characters that the four actors play. There's lots of dialogue in the short story. But Patrick White was a great lover of the theatre. He wrote some of the major Australian plays. But I was intrigued to sort of go back to his prose, which is highly poetic and very performable. And so I read this story, and its structure and the way it took you inside its themes just felt very theatrical to me.
And then what do you do? Well, I see a copy of this short story with red ink all over it, and maybe a bit of blood as well.
And what do you mean by that?
Well, you know, you've got this... It's written in prose.
Yeah.
You know, do you then have a go at just writing that as dialogue and action? What actually physically happens to that paper?
So what we did 3 years ago now, the four actors joined me in a studio for 3 days, and we started reading it together, and we literally started to share. So this feels like a young man. There's an older man, an older woman, a younger man, and a young woman. That's the quartet of actors. And on pure instinct, we started to divide up the story, sometimes a half a sentence at a time, sometimes a whole sort of passage. The dialogue, we started to realise which actors should inhabit which characters. And what's really theatrical about that in performance is that in one moment you're inside a scene as a character, and then you flip the switch and you're now speaking the inner thoughts of another character that walks past you in the next scene. So the actors are constantly moving between enactment in being in character, in scenes, in narration, but also in this in-between world where they're sort of inhabiting the interior lives of the characters. So, as I say, it's pretty much a word-for-word adaptation. There wasn't actually any literary adaptation. Sometimes we call it a theatricalisation because all of the words are there apart from a few he saids and she saids, and there's one short story, one short vignette that we cut out towards the end. But if you see the show and then you picked up the book, you'd pretty much be reading the script for the show.
And as you've suggested, the writer already had a theatrical kind of soul.
Yeah, he's incredibly theatrical in his writing, and there's something about the characters that just come to life in performance.
A slightly invasive question, but it's well-intentioned. So what about you? You, from that moment where, you know, it's the beginning. I never know what the beginning is, but in this case there's some sort of decision to turn this into a play, and then there's you amongst all these actors, and then there's you having to bring this to the stage. What's going on for you in that journey?
Well, that's an interesting one on this project, because this is not something we've done before, taking a piece of prose and theatricalising it. And in fact, when I read it, I originally thought it might be for one actor, and one actor on a bare stage, but that didn't seem to work. And the way that we stage it is that the audience sit. It's in the round, but it's not simply in the round with the stage at the centre of it. There's wide concentric circles. It'll be in the Spiegel tent, and the actors walk in the rows between the audience and up and down the aisles and in the centre as well. So the performance happens all around the audience. And then sitting amongst the audience is a string quartet. So you might find yourself next to a cellist or a violinist. And so for me, when we began that process, it was, I guess, when you've got prose, there's a lot of images in the language. And so the simple question is, what are you going to look at? What are the actors going to do apart from just saying the words? How does it turn into theatre?
But is that when you then have to take the risk and take liberty beyond what you're reading as a story?
Yeah, I think in any work you're looking for what are the given parameters of the idea, of the play or the piece of theatre that you want to make, and those limitations or the parameters start to sort of make demands on you. So, again, it wasn't about changing the language. It was saying, how do you turn this passage that describes a young girl hiding in the shade of her garden because she doesn't want to go to her aunt's funeral, and it's full of the descriptions of how the light falls on her skin. And you can imagine it as a piece of cinema or as a piece of theatre that's lit by a lighting designer, but it's also there in the language. So that was a conundrum for us on what we do. And it's a combination of this setting in which the audience are there with the audience, and we place the young woman at the centre, and she's just like she would be in a film. She's sort of picking at her nails. Nigel lights it beautifully, but then an actor walks around right in her personal space and describes the mood that she's in and how the light falls on her cheek. He's almost touching her, and the music sort of takes us to an atmosphere, and suddenly you feel like almost like this young man is a ghost sort of wandering around this young woman, and that speaks to some of the ideas of the ghost of this woman. So it's the form of it helped us to unlock the theatricality.
Nigel's sitting next to us, by the way, and his name's been invoked, so what's his full name?
Nigel Levings is our lighting designer, yeah. One of Australia's most acclaimed lighting designers.
We're going to bring you in a sec, Nigel, if you don't mind, but I'm still pushing a little bit further. Yeah. There comes a moment then where you, whether it's script or not, have to add to the story that's there to serve it as a piece of theatre, maybe more visual stuff, and does that feel a bit like a duty to do that really well, because this is someone else's story, and you know, and at some point you then become a collaborator, don't you, with the writer of the story?
Yeah, absolutely. You certainly do. Patrick White was always hungry for directors to take on his plays, and the more adventurous the interpretation, the happier he was. He was an ambitious and demanding artist of his own writing.
So you felt permission?
Yes. Well, we went to his estate, and his agent, who is her own sort of high profile presence in Australia, is the executor of his artistic will, his literary will. So to get her to agree to us doing this production took some convincing,
right,
because she wanted to know that she was in good hands. But once she understood that we were going to be very bold with it, then it was like a collaboration. She said, "You're really taking on the spirit."
Yeah, we're just going to order some tea. I'll have a cup of tea with milk, please. Thanks.
I might grab a white coffee, thank you.
Nigel's going to get something too. So you didn't feel they'd kill you if you got it wrong?
No, there was a kind of confidence in what we were going to do. For people who don't know Patrick White's writing, I mean, one of his contemporaries was Barry Humphries. And so in that sort of, there's a tonal thing in some of the performance style. Not all of it, but it can go to the kind of large grotesque, and Patrick played with gender. So the matriarch, the woman who's the sister of Days, the conservative woman, is played by Paul Blackwell, the older male. And so there's a wonderful sense of playfulness and gender fluidity and all of those things. And that was all very much in keeping with Patrick White's style.
Yeah. And we're just showing our tickets too. This is a perfect. We were from London. But Nigel, I couldn't help overhearing you two, bumped into you here on the train. You two had a conversation that went on for an hour that seemed to be hugely detailed about, you know, finessing and improving and changing. And, you know, I was surprised in a good way about how much depth and detail goes into just the lighting of a piece like this. So is that how it's always done?
I guess it can be, yes. And Chris and I were actually talking about another production which we're doing in September at the Barbican, a fantastic piece that Chris did called Memorial. But it's very interesting, the relationship between lighting designer and director, and it works best, I feel, when there is a sort of intuitive response from the lighting designer to what the director is doing, the way the work is happening, and that seems to me the best process, and I think that's sort of why directors and lighting designers tend to, as they say, hunt in packs. You know, like you find some people that you like working with, whose work you respect and whose taste and judgment you trust, and simply because there's actually there's so little time to prepare the work in the theatre that there has to be, in the director's part, a huge amount of trust in what the lighting designer is preparing, simply because you just, as a director, you don't have time to stand there and look over every single decision that's being made.
And I wonder, because sometimes this has been found to be challenging when I put this to people, but it's because I've heard it before in a proper collaboration. But I'd say, particularly when you're trying to imagine the story on the stage, is a good lighting designer serves your imagination, Chris, but also enhances and disrupts it.
I think you put that exactly right. I mean, there's everything needs to fall in alignment. All of the collaborators need to be going towards the same vision, but it's no use to anybody if everybody is simply doing what the director demands, because that's then you're looking at technicians. So you're looking for the director's job is to say, how do I create a clarity of vision that everybody can feed in their own vision and we all harmonise together? And it always, like Nigel was saying, you look for those people with a similar vision, and each project is different. Like Nigel and I have done a number of shows together now. We did a Tartuffe.
I'm just going to pause this as we hear another player in our interview making great apologies for our late journey. Okay, so carry on with
that. I was just going to say, we did a Tartuffe we did a couple of years ago, and I don't think we had, in one way, I don't think we had more than a half an hour conversation on that one, because there was a sort of rightness that we just both knew. Other projects require a bit more conversation, but it always comes from a base of mutual respect and a shared sensibility. But yes, in terms of the amount of detail that works, like for a minute of stage time, there's hours and hours and hours over months and years that come back to that moment again and again and again and again. So
The reason I love doing these first interviews on a train is because this journey is not going to plan. We're half an hour late. You never quite know. And this train is going to drop you, I believe, at a Spiegel tent. Yeah. Not a venue, you know, maybe you'd have even chosen initially when you first imagined this. So as this train stops outside the Spiegel tent 40 minutes late and unloads both of you into that beautiful round venue, how are you going to claim that space in what is a very short space of time here at the Fringe?
That's a very pertinent question, because this production normally has its own set, and which includes sort of real grass in a black box theatre, our wooden chairs, and then we hang a canvas canopy over the entire roof or the ceiling of the theatre, and Nigel bounces light down, and it's used like in a, what we call it, like under a canvas Australian sky. We're doing none of that in Edinburgh. So in a couple of hours, Nigel's going to relight in a totally different way the entire show. Even I think,
totally reconceive the production.
Is that a pain in the arse or a joy?
Look, it's an interesting challenge, and this show in particular has some very strange challenges, and the principal challenge about it is that the actors are always in extremely close proximity to an audience, and normally in a theatrical space, the actors are lit in a way that most audience members would find extremely uncomfortable to be in, high glare levels, lights shining in their eyes all the time, and this is a solution that we can't do, because we have to light the audience and the actors equally, and the audience has to be able to see the actors clearly, because one of the magic things about this particular production is the fantastic thing of being standing right next to an actor and watching, as you do in one case with Paul Blackwell, where he he turns in the matter of 4 or 5 seconds from being a grave digger to being the grieving sister to being the minister welcoming the grieving sister. And that's all just like bang, 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 instantaneous changes of character. And it's a miraculous thing to see with an actor doing that sort of stuff. But you have to be able to see it. And that's going to be the critical dilemma for us in the Spiegeltent, about how we do that.
So we're being announced again, but I can be heard here. And the thing I'm really interested in knowing, too, about this is we go back to the short story, okay? That's a piece of writing. This is a piece of acting. Do you think that the short story writer of this, when they see this, might have written the story differently, having seen it?
Oh, look, of course, I don't know. But one of the wonderful things that we've discovered that must be in the bones of the story, and it's a bit hard to describe without knowing the whole show, but the actors obviously need to double up certain characters. And there are there's two relationships between four people. You go back through time to when Daisy was alive, and the relationship she had with an outcast from society, this older man, and it's an illicit relationship, and it's the one that appalled the community, and he's at the graveside grieving, and through his memory we see that relationship between Daisy and Ozzy. That's one relationship. And then we've got this tryst that I mentioned in the cemetery between the young niece who skips away and meets her neighbour in the dump. Those four characters are played by the two same young actors. And what you start to see in the production is the thematic echoes that Patrick White must have seen about this generational similarity between the aunt and her niece, and them both wanting to be outside the confines of society, and both the young boy who's a neighbour and the scabby old man, as he's described, are outcasts as well. So the production has revealed sort of some of the internal skeleton of the dramatist.
And I love the idea that Patrick White would be humble, I'm sure he is, and would see this and go, oh, I need to go and rewrite.
He's very famous for being an incredibly intimidating man who took no prisoners. Mobbs, who is his agent, said she thought he'd be very pleased with it, which meant a lot to us.
That's good. Final question. The 12, 13-year-old version of you that you remember comes to see this production. What do you think they think of the grown-up version of themselves?
Well, I think they'd be pretty through it, actually. You know, I didn't come from an arts world, and I think it's a great privilege and a great joy. I've got a daughter who at 15 came and saw it and loved being inside that, and I guess I saw a bit of myself through her eyes on a moment like that, which you always do. No, it's great.
Chris, Nigel, thanks for talking to Fringe Review and also the staff on this train.